On this episode of War Docs, we speak with retired Navy Commander Dr. Ramon Sestero, an experienced trauma surgeon, innovator, and entrepreneur. Ramon talks about his experiences deploying multiple times across the globe and how these events shaped his approach to trauma surgery. Dr. Sestero talks about the circumstances that led him to design and develop an innovative surgical retractor that provides excellent exposure and is optimized for use in battlefield environments where speed and transportability are critical considerations. He describes the process of getting an idea from the bench to widespread use in operating rooms across the globe and discusses challenges and setbacks and how they were overcome. Dr. Sestero explains his view of the current gaps in trauma surgery research and what innovations he sees coming on the horizon. Find out more about Dr. Sestero and our previous guests on our website, and make sure you follow War Docs on your preferred podcast platform and subscribe to our War Docs YouTube channel. I'm your host, Dr. Doug Soderdahl, retired Army urologist, and I'm joined today by my co-host, Dr. Wayne Causey, active duty vascular surgeon.
Welcome to War Docs, the military medicine podcast. This show brings you a firsthand, behind-the-scenes look into the mission, unique opportunities, and deployed experiences of the entire military healthcare team. From state-of-the-art hospitals in the United States to the most austere environments across the globe, War Docs has you covered.
Today, we're privileged to welcome trauma surgeon Ramon Sestero to War Docs. Ramon, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
In our last interview, we discussed many interesting topics in your career, to include your training and experience as a Navy trauma surgeon and why a surgeon would want to obtain an MBA. Since then, you have used both skills collectively to innovate surgical care. Can you tell us, having completed 7 deployments, including 3 to the combat zones, what are some of the most challenging and impactful experiences that have shaped your approach to trauma surgery?
I spent quite a bit of time in austere, remote, isolated environments, where everything was just a little more challenging, right? You're taking indirect fire, you have limited equipment, limited lighting, limited exposure. And so after multiple experiences in that kind of environment, I think I came away with a number of lessons. One of the key ones is that having the right equipment is just critical. I think we all appreciate that here when we're working in a civilian environment, but particularly in an austere remote setting where everything is just harder, having the right equipment is key. And unfortunately, you know, as combat physicians, not a lot of equipment is designed for us specifically. And so we just tend to struggle. We just make do with what we have. But when you don't have equipment that works, I think outcomes are worse. The other key lesson I think I've learned over those deployments is that time really matters. I think working in a civilian environment, we really get used to a sense of abundance. We always have, you know, more people, more time, more blood products. And when you're in a resource limited setting, you don't. And so being fast, being efficient, being effective really promotes good care, I think downrange. And so I think working quickly and efficiently and having that mindset when you're deployed leads to success. And lastly, I think adaptability, make sure you're adaptable to different environments, whether you're working on a ship, on the back of an aircraft, in a tent, or in a Roll 3, you need to be able to adapt to the setting. You don't always need that particular suture, that particular GIA. Just you make do with what you have. And when I was in Iraq, our convoys, were blown up pretty frequently. So we lost our level 1 infuser fairly early our deployment, and we never had to replace it. It kept getting blown up on the way in. And so we just had one medic that would just squeeze a bag. That was his or her job.
One of the things on War Docs that we've talked to a lot of folks that have a lot of active duty experience, and you have active duty experience, but you also decided to join the reserves. Tell us a little about what impacted your decision to join the reserves, and how was that as a trauma surgeon serving in the Navy reserves?
I really enjoyed my time in the reserves. After I finished my 10 years on active duty, I deployed several times, as we've talked about. I thought it was time to then transition into civilian practice and then transition to academics, which I was interested in. But I still want to stay connected to the military. So the reserves was a great opportunity to do that. The time commitment was less, 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year. It allowed me to finish my 20 years. So I'm now proud to say I'm retired reserves from the Navy. But the toll on the family was a little bit much after the frequency of deployments back in the 2000s, early 2010s. But the reserves was a really good opportunity. It allowed me to balance both, like civilian practice with staying connected to the, military lifestyle. One thing that was different though is the camaraderie and sense of mission that I think we practice, every day when we go into a military facility and work with their active duty military colleagues. You only interact with these individuals, once a month and maybe during your 2-week deployment. So you lose a little bit of that. But in general, it's a really good opportunity.
So given your experiences, would you have any suggestions of how they could improve it for surgeons in the reserves to get more experience maybe with the team? How would you do it differently?
The challenge, I think, with the, at least the Navy reserve side, is that they try to cram in all the administrative requirements that I think we're all familiar with on an MTF or a large organization. You try to cram all that you do over a month into one weekend. So most of your time is really doing your online training, fire extinguisher training, things like that. And so you don't really have the opportunity to work as a team. You're really just doing training for most of those weekends. Now, when you do your 2 weeks, you might go out to the field. It allows you to participate in your actual profession, setting up field hospitals, et cetera. But the time requirements for the administrative components really just take up the majority of your experience on the single weekends, at least in the Navy. I'm not sure if it's different for the Air Force or the Army, but there is just really not a lot of time to actually do more camaraderie.
Now, in the last episode that we interviewed you, we went into detail about your career, but we only very briefly touched the surface of one of the areas of innovation in combat surgery and surgical care and civilian practice that you've been a pioneer and an innovator in. And that's the field of abdominal surgery and the development of a retractor. Can you tell us how your experiences as a military trauma surgeon inspired you to help design and create a new retractor?
During most of my deployments, in a resource limited setting, we work with equipment that's given to us and we don't really have the option for other instruments. As both of you know, when we deploy, we use the Balfour retractor, a retractor designed in 1911. It's a simple design, does its job, essentially provides initial entry into the abdomen. But I found that it was just not effective downrange. Especially in our small surgical team, we were seeing some of the most severely injured casualties that we'd seen in our careers, and we're working in a tent or a building of opportunity, getting access to the abdomen for taking care of a combination of an iliac artery injury and a kidney and a liver and a spleen. Really, we were pressed with on time. We didn't have platelets. In the Role 2 setting, we just didn't have platelets. We had to really work very quickly. And we found that we were having challenges obtaining adequate exposure and doing the case in an adequate time frame. And so after multiple deployments where I would come home and I found myself having the same frustrations at home at 2 a.m, I found that at 2 a.m in a level 1 center is not too dissimilar from an austere setting in a resource limitation setting, especially in a county hospital, that I had the same frustration. I thought to myself, why can't we develop, why hasn't a retractor been developed that combines both that speed and efficiency of a Balfour retractor with a table mounted system? Book Walter Thompson, whatever it might be. And so that's what really led me to it. There were a couple of injuries downrange that really kind of set it in mind that I think we needed to do this. And once I had the opportunity,
Was there a particular case where you said, man, something's just got to be done to do it better than we're doing it?
There were multiple cases that brought this frustration to life. But I think the one that really cemented it for me, it was a young soldier involved in a suicide-borne vehicle IED. He came in hypotensive, was missing a couple of limbs, had tourniquets on. We resuscitated him in the ED, took him into the OR fairly quickly, and he ended up having an assortment of bad injuries. He had an iliac artery injury, he had a kidney, liver, spleen, small bowel mesentery, and he'd already been bleeding quite a bit from being in the field. And we worked as quickly as we could. However, to get adequate exposure, my assistant, who was another surgeon, was tied up with a couple of handhelds. We had our tech in there with a couple of handhelds, and that just left me to to create exposure and, you know, actually do the procedure. So we got it done fairly expeditiously, but unfortunately we didn't make it. It took us too long. And I thought to myself after that, you know, if we had something that worked better, could we have saved him? And so that's the patient I think that at least I struggled with. I'm sure I'm not the only one that struggled, not just downrange, but here in civilian practice. Well, if we had been faster, more effective, could we have made a difference? And I think that's the one that cemented it for me.
Since you've innovated in the field of surgical retractors, have you done much research in looking into the history of surgical retractors? I know I, for one, trained in vascular surgery in University of California, San Francisco, and that's where an Omni retractor was designed. And so I'm just curious if you've looked into that research or the development of different retractor systems.
Yeah, during this process, I became interested in it and how did this get done and what prompted other surgeons to go down this path. So a little bit of history, you know, back in the Renaissance, when surgery was becoming more, more mature, initially it was just hands. And so from hands became hooks to get tissues out of the way. The Sen retractor was probably one of the first ones to get invented, I think in the mid 1800s or so. From that, the Wheatlander self-retaining system came out. And that was actually from a surgeon, Dr. Wheatlander, who was working at communities, or he was a community surgeon, and he found he couldn't get enough help. He didn't have enough surgical assistance. So he developed a retractor to kind of help himself. And so that just developed over time as the operations became more complicated. And there's a need for it. In the abdominal surgery space, it started again with hands and then self-retaining system. I think the Smith retractor was one of the first ones that's similar to the Balfour. Balfour eventually got introduced in about 1911. It's still used today, still the most commonly used non-table mounted retractor in the world. In the 1960s or so, then the table mounted systems came along. The Brooke Walter introduced his in 1978 or so. 1965 was a Thompson. He was a general surgeon actually selling his retractor in California out of his garage, really just designing a retractor that he needed to be better. And Dr. Bookwalter was incentivized by his experience at Harvard as a medical student, where he was frustrated that he was just retracting, falling asleep, and really not learning anything, just pulling hooks. And so that was his big impetus to create something better. He really just improved on the current systems that were available, the Smith and the other table mounted systems. But he was one of the first ones to design one with a single post. And so that was one unique aspect of it. The other innovation was he created a system that he placed after the drapes. The other ones had to be placed before the drapes. So whether you position it correctly or not was an issue. And so those were two of his big contributions to the field of surgery. It's the most commonly used non-table retractor in the world.
So take us a little bit behind the scenes of the process of designing and developing the retractor that you worked on. How does it get from that back of the napkin initial stage into early prototypes and then into production?
I decided that I would wait until I left the military to pursue this, just to simplify the process. I transitioned from active duty here at BAMC to University of Texas, UT Health San Antonio, where I joined the faculty there. And I was throwing around some ideas in my head about, you know, what I would do if I had the opportunity. I didn't have a formal pathway. And I received an email from the Office of Technology Commercialization, which is really their tech transfer office. And every major university has this. I didn't know they existed before I embarked on this. And it said, hey, do you have an idea? And I said, yes, I do. And so you basically send in a description of it when you look a little bit into the commercialization and give some forecasts on where this could go. And then they do their own due diligence at the tech transfer office. And they saw there was actually a potential commercial possibility here, potential for it. They will submit the patents for you for intellectual property protection, because without that, it's really hard to kind of go forward. And I applied for some grants for prototype development. I had teamed up with a biomedical engineer who's my co-inventor. We threw around some ideas and eventually got some funding for a prototype, built a very crude prototype. And then we didn't know of the concept of blades under tension would support a ring like a Bookwalter system. And so that just hadn't been proven yet. We eventually found a cadaver opportunity after a study. And we tested it out in a laparotomy, and it worked. Very, very happy to see that. And after that, the school asked me to form a company, because that taking that next step from a functional prototype to commercialization and really doing the formal research and development, it's fairly complicated and time consuming. I had a social colleague that had run companies in the past. He was available as a CEO. He looked at technology, and we decided to form a company around it, did that. And then the next step was fundraising. This is not an inexpensive process. You have to hire individuals, hire attorneys, your engineers. It's patent attorneys. And so it can be expensive. And so then we embarked on a friends and family round. We have a number of surgeon investors that had become part of the company. And from there, we hired our research and development engineering firm to develop it. Took us about 9 months or so to get to the final prototype. I brought in military surgeons, civilian nurses, techs, residents. And so I really wanted input from all stakeholders into how the process worked or the prototype worked. And once we had a final prototype, then we moved to commercialization. So we hired a sales team, did some market research, and then started here in San Antonio. UT Health San Antonio was the first hospital. Brookline Medical Center was the second one, and then moved on to Austin. And now we're nationwide. In fact, we're international. We've gone over through 40 level one centers. Brookline Medical Center has it, Walter Reed, Fort Belvoir, Naval Medical Center, Lejeune, and the Canadian military has purchased it, or is in the process of purchase for their level three military hospital. So it's been a really fun process, but definitely it requires some dedication and time.
So what did you find was your greatest challenge in this whole process? I mean, it sounds like the whole thing is a challenge, but what was the one biggest sticking point that you found?
I think time management was the biggest challenge. So I was full-time surgeon at the university. I was active faculty. I was a chair of the faculty senate. I was ICU director. I was also starting some leadership programs at the university to train our younger faculty on negotiation skills and some other administrative aspects of our everyday life. And so to balance, starting a company and having investor meetings, attorney meetings, sales meetings, R&D meetings, with your full-time job, I was doing this post-call, weekends, nights. And so it became a challenge. So the way I solved that was going 75% 1 year and then 50% the year after that. And then after that, I decided I needed to either commit to the company to make it successful or stay at the hospital. Now I'm now full time.
So let's talk a little bit about the technology of this retractor. How is it different from other either table mounted or self-retracting abdominal retractors? And I know that you have, I guess, a prototype or an actual one with you. If you could just explain, what is it that's different? What kind of exposure does it provide? How easy it to set up? Whatever you want to say that's different.
So what I was really looking for is a system that's easy, intuitive, can be assembled quickly, and can be inserted to the abdomen in a rapid manner, with the functionality of our table-mounted systems, whether it's a Thompson, a Buchwalter, or any other competitors. I wanted something that was fast but effective. And so what we did is really merge those two technologies. First of all, we want to make it very light. And so it's all titanium. The system, really, is 10 pieces. It can get assembled in about 16 seconds is our record. A couple of things we did is made a one-way assembly. So the components can only be attached one way. They can't be attached backwards as they can with many of our retractor systems. That's a frustration I think I've experienced, other surgeons have experienced when they get a handed a retractor that's been assembled backwards. And so we designed some things that I think are common frustrations with surgeons from the get-go. The whole system weighs 2 pounds. It can be adapted for different incisions. So these are the four blades that connect to the fascia. So basically you insert this in and it ratchets out, similar to the Balfour system with that satisfying ratcheting sound, so you know it's locked in. Once it's in place, you've got 4 points of contact on the fascia, and now you can attach Buchwalter components all the way circumferentially around it. And so I have a demo here that the abdominal surgical model that we use for training, which I think will show that for you. And so imagine this being your standard, you know, laparotomy incision. And so you make your incision, this gets assembled by your tech. And essentially you just insert this. Now you clear your bowel from underneath your blades. This is just basically like your bowel four blades. Now you have four points of contact. And now one person on one side or one person can do it by themselves. You basically just ratchet it out. And now you've really exposed that abdominal wall is, you know, basically to the level of your Bookwalter. This ends up being a little bit wider than your Bookwalter system. So you get a little more lateral retraction. So you can get to operating right now, put a clamp on a bleeding structure or just operate like this. There are some surgeons that like to operate just with this design and the way you see it. I prefer to add the Bookwalter components. So these are Bookwalter blades or there are a lot of Bookwalter knockoffs, but if it works on a Bookwalter ring, you can attach anywhere here. The way we use it now, we recommend that surgeons start off with it. It's starting to expand the corners. And so again, these are just Bookwalter blades, just like you have and used before. So the familiarity of surgeons to using the system, it's really equipment that they already use. It's just in a different format. And so the way I do my cases now, I've done about 30, 35 cases with this. I basically start by putting four medium Richardsons on the corners. And as you can see, we've really expanded that incision. We've got four points of contact in the abdominal wall. And then to get to the retroperitoneum, a couple of malleables. Imagine that being bowel. And this is similar to what I've done in actual cases. You see that graphic on the bottom of the aorta and the IVC. I've actually done this exact case with this equipment where I've exposed the left iliac artery using just like this. So now I can get to the retroperitoneum in 90 seconds or so, where it would normally take me 10, 15 minutes with the Bookwalter setup, et cetera. You can use this in the ICU. You can use it in the trauma bay. And the austere environment where you don't have the option of a Bookwalter rail or the bed rail, this is the exposure you can get by yourself, you know, in a combat environment. And so, it's just that simple. We really designed it to be intuitive. The button functionality is very similar to what we already use. I mean, we made it all thumb activated. At the end of the case, you just remove the equipment like you would with your Bofor or your Bookwalter. It all snaps off. Again, you know, these are just Richardsons and malleables, but if you like Devers, you like ribbons, whatever connects to your Bookwalter system, you can use with this device as well. The end of the case, thumb activated, it collapses, and take it out, hand it off, and that's the end of your disassembly.
So just a quick question. As a urologist, you know, we like to operate deep in the pelvis and deep in a hole. If you needed to have upward retraction on the entire retractor to give you kind of some more volume, could you mount it to the table if you needed to or wanted to?
Yep, absolutely. So I designed it with options in mind. I mentioned earlier, this is actually set up for a large incision, but you can bring these in for smaller incisions. So really you can adapt it for what you need. But if you need upward lift, let's say you work in the upper abdomen or you're just looking for that typical table mounted system exposure, you can easily attach it to it's compatible with the ring, with the post. So you just attach it in the corner like you normally do and treat it like a Bookwalter. Most of my cases, I haven't had to do that. The reason I don't use the Bookwalter is because of time limitation, typically in a trauma setting, and the post gets in my way. But if you find yourself that's what you need, you can definitely use that with this system.
Well, I'll tell you an interesting story. The first time I had encountered the Titan retractor was actually in Baghdad. And you had mailed in an envelope, actually, like a large gray envelope to Colonel Dr. Kirby Gross, the Titan retractor. And I was actually sitting in his office when someone delivered it to him. And I actually handed it across to him. And I was actually baffled by the fact that there was a retractor in there because it was so light. Like you mentioned, it was 2 pounds versus when I've had to move a Bookwalter during the deployment. You know, you're talking about two men, you know, you're basically picking it up with two hands. It's in a large case. And so it has to be, but I'm going to link this to a question. So I was amazed at how light it was. But one of the things that I think a lot of surgeons find themselves with is that we like to do things the same way all the time. And so I say that because even changing simple things such as a pickup or the way you do something is difficult, much less the entry into the abdomen. And so what have you found are sort of the feedback and tips that you've given surgeons when they've wanted to make a change? Because you're talking about changing something in an emergency setting, which is already stressful enough to the surgeon, much less adding something that's different.
You know, when I started this process, I knew this was going to be a challenge. Surgeons are opinionated, I think, as we all know. But we're trained a certain way, right? So we're trained in residency to do something using a certain system. Then we go out and practice. We become very good at it using that certain system. And you need to have a really good reason to change. With that in mind, we designed it with button functionality that's thumb activated, similar to the equipment we use. It integrates with the Bookwalter system, which a lot of surgeons, if not most, use in their daily practice. I created it so that the hurdle to get a surgeon to use it would be fairly low. In fact, it's so low that some surgeons say, well, I really like this device. I want to trial it. And I offer training and they say, I don't need any training. It's a Balfour to Bookwalter. I know how to use those two systems, but I don't think I need it. And we tried that. Unfortunately, there are differences. I compare it to driving a rental car. When you get in your rental car, you know how to drive it. You're going to get out of that parking lot. You're going to get to your destination, but everything is a little bit different position and you're going to get better the more you drive it. And so I think it's the same with this retractor. It is different enough that it requires some training. So what we do is we do cadaver labs. I come in. In fact, I'm going this week to a hospital in Houston where I come with a cut suit, abdominal simulator, and I give them a 20-minute PowerPoint presentation. I let them use it. I suggest that they take it apart, put it together, because oftentimes that's challenging for your tech who may not know the technology. And so it requires a little bit of training, but it is so similar to what we already use that, you know, after a couple of cases, you've been pretty good at it. What I tell surgeons is that it's not magic. You do have to work with it a little bit. You have to familiarize yourself with it before the OR, before 2 a.m. And once you do, once you have 4 hot cases under your belt, now you can really get creative with it and use it, you know, to its best ability. There are some surgeons that come up and say, the warehouse has been all my life. And there are others that are happy with their current system. And that's great. I really designed it for those that find that there's a need in the technology. And for those surgeons, it has worked really well.
Well, this is probably an Army thing, but I have a colleague that used to drive everyone crazy because when he would try to assemble the Bookwalter, he would use the Army command of Bookwalter post. And so I think that may be one of the major things that would cause him to not want to change is he could use his stupid command from the Army. But another question I had is, you know, so this, it seems perfectly situated for abdominal surgery, but what about like flank surgery, perineal surgery, thoracic surgery? Where do you see the use of this type of retractor in other areas of the body?
The design, you know, especially during our R&D stage, it was typical to design a product that can work for every patient, small, large, wide, obese, no obese. So we went through a number of prototypes as far as sizes, lengths, widths, et cetera. This is where I was talking about that I brought a lot of other surgeons in to get their opinions. What we ended up doing is going with this design that I find to be, I call it the 90% retractor. It works in probably 90% of cases. For the abdomen, it's really optimized for that. Now, we have had interest in other parts of the body. We have had interest actually from pediatric cardiac surgery team at a major university because they have challenges sometimes with obese children that they can't get the finichetto down to the chest. There's so much subcutaneous tissue in the upper part of the body that they just can't get it down there. And it actually has led to some poor outcomes. So they want to use this system to create space and then be able to insert the finichetto. So I have gone to the cadaver lab. I have tested out. I've been able to do a thoracotomy with it. It's kind of unique because I can use Bookwalter blades to bring the lung up and actually isolate the aorta, which is not something we can do with the finichetto. But it's not designed for that, but it can be done for it. We use that in cadaver courses for clamshells. It works really well for that. It has been used by transplant surgeons at University Hospital for kidney transplants. So it can be used in any incision where you can fit this in, usually about 13 centimeters or greater. But if you need retraction of subcutaneous tissue and it's appropriate size, this retractor can.
And for our listeners, when we hear the word finichetto, what we're talking about is a rib spreader. And so when you're doing a thoracotomy or you need a retractor that separates the ribs so that you can get into the thoracic cavity, there's actually particular maneuvers that military surgeons teach each other, particularly pre-deployment, where you flip it around backwards, et cetera, so that you can take it across the chest. Which he's talking about was the clamshell operation, where you actually extend the one chest to the other with a single incision all the way across the chest, so you can get to the chest, the lungs, the heart, and everything that's involved. So on that military theme note, we talk now about large-scale combat operations, LISCO, and multi-domain operations. What do you think are the features that are going to be necessary if we do go to one of those large-scale conflicts where we're encountering large numbers of casualties?
I think over the last 20 years, we've been very accustomed to counter-insurgency operations where we really own the battle space. We own the air, most of the land. There really wasn't a lot of sea to talk about, but this is going to be a very different next engagement. You know, a Taiwan, something in Russia, Middle East. This is going to be, from what, at least what I've read, much more similar to the casualty numbers we saw in World War II. Where, you know, during Operation Overlord, I think there were upwards of 2,300 casualties per day. That's not what we saw at all, during our combat experience. So I think it's going to be a little bit or a lot different mentality. The number of casualties is going to be significantly more. And so we're going to need to be more efficient, more effective, faster, essentially, especially with the, you know, limited number of surgeons that we may have at that point if the current trends continue. The other difference, I think, is going to be the prolonged field care component of it. The fact that we're able to do damage control surgery far forward, you know, basically stopping bleeding and contamination, and almost immediately on a phone call, getting them to the next level of care to a number of vascular surgeons, neurosurgeons, wherever you might need. I think those days are long gone. We are going to be holding on to patients for much longer. We won't be able to transfer them as quickly. So those initial damage control procedures may be reoperated on by the same surgeon in a forward environment to really do more of the completion. And so I think those are going to be two of the biggest changes. I think the Navy will probably play a much larger role working on ships. I think Army, Air Force, Navy surgeons, we're probably going to be fairly flexible and working in different environments, depending on where that platform might be. You know, the old hospital ship concept, I'm not sure if that's going to work. And we know that in Ukraine, medical facilities are targeted. And so it would be just another target on the ocean. So having more mobile surgical teams on the water might be a new concept. I know the Navy's working on that currently. And so I think, from a big picture is really adaptability, which is a common concept I think we talked about earlier, and just being more effective, more efficient, being able to operate in different platforms.
So they say that necessity is the mother of invention. What do you see as the current gaps in trauma surgery research that are of interest to you? And what innovations do you see in the next 5 to 10 years in trauma surgery?
Hemorrhage, continues to be the leading cause of death and trauma, both downrange and stateside. And so I think we'll continue to see efforts to make blood product access easier, faster, cheaper. Hemoglobin oxygen carrier substitutes, freeze-dried platelets, freeze-dried plasma, the ability to provide blood transfusions farther forward, maybe to the point of injury. I think we'll see that definitely in the next 5, 10, 15 years. From a surgical perspective, particularly from a retractor perspective, which is really what I'm interested in, exposure, making surgery easier is really bottom line. I think one of the big challenges and the gaps now is the transition to minimally invasive robotic surgery. During my training, I did a lot more open surgery than I did minimally invasive, and it's the exact opposite now. And so I think that skill set in working or performing difficult and challenging open procedures, particularly in trauma, there's less of that now for residents as they graduate. And I think that struggle continues, its first few years out as well. And so how do we replace that? Training and simulators is challenging. So I don't have an answer for that, but what I do know is make easier can make exposure for any surgeon, the better they're going to do in the operating room. That has been one of my goals, is just making the whole job of getting to whatever structure you're trying to get to faster and easier. The faster you can get to it, the better that patient's going to do. And I think the faster we make it for a new trainee that isn't super comfortable in the abdomen and obtaining, you know, exposure of the duodenum and iliac, et cetera, I think it'll ultimately lead to better outcomes. Taking in mind this, the reduction in open abdominal cases that they're doing.
So when I look at your retractor, I think to myself, well, he added some Bookwalter components to it. Is there the next iteration of the Titan retractor that we're going to see on the horizon that has 8 parts to it or other components? Or what's next for the Titan?
We're still in the commercialization phase. It's still considered a relatively new product. We've been now out about 3 years. I imagine there's probably been over 1,000 cases done with it. We're moving international now. We're talking to some countries overseas that are interested in carrying the product. Really, my focus right now is just getting the word out, letting people see it, and if there's interest, then training them on how to use it. And so that's taking the majority of our focus. We do have some ideas coming down the line. You know, I think in the operating room, I think if you ask any surgeon, there are 100 things that we could do that could be better in there to make the experience better for not just the patient, but for the entire staff. And so exposure, I think, is just the first one. I think lighting could be optimized, integrating suction. I think there are other things we could do for open surgery that has really gone by the wayside just because there's been such a focus on minimally invasive. But open abdominal surgery, I think, will continue to be the gold standard for a long time to come for complicated cases or life-threatening cases. So I think there are opportunities there to make the system better. And hopefully, by doing that, improving patient outcomes.
Yeah, I think that's just an amazing, insightful point that today's trainees are so accustomed, you could say spoiled, to the exposure they get from minimally invasive surgery. They see everything. I think when they are confronted with open surgery that they don't do on a daily basis, I think having that better exposure, better lighting that they're used to would make a huge difference. So I applaud you for that.
No, thanks. No, in fact, I'm an instructor for the Air Force Ground Surgical Teams here in San Antonio. And so I teach twice a month. And I get 2 Air Force surgeons that are usually recently out of training. And in 3 days, I turn them from a non-trauma surgeon to a trauma surgeon where we do splenectomies, nephrectomies, you know, shunts. And one of my, one of the key things I focus on is generating exposure, whether you need to bring in extra people. You know, I don't use my retractor because we don't have it available there. But we talk about it because if they can't see, they can't operate. And so it's just really a repetition concept, but they usually underappreciate the importance of that to do successful trauma surgery.
So I might be spoiled, but I had a Bookwalter on all my deployments and at every hospital I think I've ever worked at. And so it would obviously work with your Titan retractor. Have you been to a hospital that didn't have an existing retractor that would supplement the Titan?
No. One of the reasons I chose a Bookwalter as the model, I mean, the Bookwalter is a great system. It's just, it has a downside of time to set up and the post. And so, but once you have the exposure in place, I think it's a really good system. So when I was trying to think about what to combine to take away the detractions, the disadvantages, and retain the advantages of each system, I picked the Balfour and the Bookwalter because I would expect it everywhere. I mean, I found it in Iraq. I mean, there's not a hospital I've ever practiced in. I have not found the Bookwalter. And so to this point, I think I've gone over 40 hospitals and yet to this day, there's no way that doesn't have a Bookwalter-like system in place.
Well, we've been speaking with Dr. Ramon Sestero on War Docs Podcast. Ramon, thanks again for sharing your experiences and insights with us and thank you for your service to the nation.
All right. Thank you guys as well.
Thank you for listening to War Docs. We sure hope you enjoyed it. War Docs is a nonprofit organization supported by donations from listeners like you. Please follow and subscribe to our show on whatever platform you consume your podcasts, and rate and review this episode, and share the show with your contacts on social media. Find out more information about our show, our guests, and how to become a member of Team War Docs on wardocspodcast.com. Thank you for your support. If you like war stories and medical drama, War Docs has you covered. Spread the word.